Hello, my name is Maria Titizian, and welcome to EVN Talks. My guest in the studio is Dr. Arek Danagulyan, Associate Professor of Nuclear Science and Engineering at MIT. His current research interests focus on nuclear physics, applications in societal problems such as nuclear nonproliferation, technologies for arms control, treaty verification, nuclear safeguards, and so on. And he has earned recognition as an Arms Control Person of the Year in 2019. Welcome to the program, Arek.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
Everybody here at EVN Report follows your work very closely. They follow your social media work as well.
But
So you're a physicist by training, a native of Armenia, and you left, I believe, in 1993 and
moved
to the United States.
Yes.
And you've been doing, as I said, groundbreaking work. I'm going to start off with some not difficult questions, but perhaps complex questions based on your expertise and recent developments that we saw taking place in our region. How would you assess the current state and pace of Iran's nuclear program? Because this is of interest to us, obviously, in Armenia. And how significantly has it been delayed, if at all, because of the recent conflict? And obviously because if it hasn't been delayed, and if the West, Israel, and the United States are intent upon stopping it, then we can't expect future escalation. So what is the current state of play?
Yeah, so that is a complex question. And one thing to sort of keeping it short, but giving us kind of more structured understanding of what's happening, it's sort of important to understand like what's historical, what's been happening in the Iranian society for the last 30, 40 years. It would be wrong to think that Iran is like a monolithic entity where there's like one intent and one program and one drive. There's multiple different groups that are pulling different ways. And what has been happening over the last 20, 30, 40 years is very much a reflection of that. And some of these differences within Iranian society are quite counterintuitive. In, for example, most people think that the religious establishment is all for nuclear weapons, but it's actually the other way around. Ayatollah Khomeini, when he came to power, he essentially declared a fatwa on nuclear weapons and essentially declared nuclear weapons essentially haram. And that has basically put the Iranians in a situation where they cannot really admit that they're making nuclear weapons because it will mean they violated Ayatollah Khomeini's order, essentially, who has like, there's a cult of personality around him, even after his death. But overall, without going too much into the, you know, into the weeds, there is basically two forces in Iranian society. One that wants Iran to get reintegrated in the world community, and another one that really wants the bomb.
Okay. Why do they really want the bomb?
So the question is, why do countries generally want the bomb? And different countries want it for different reasons. I would not pretend to knowing it very well as to the specific reasons, but general impression that you get when looking why, and even within, even among those that want the bomb, there's different reasons. So some want it out of prestige. Other ones, different camps within the Iranian society want it out of prestige as a way that, I mean, think about it. If Iran does become a nuclear state, imagine what it will do to its prestige in the nuclear, in the Muslim world. Right.
Well, and then Israel also wouldn't have attacked it.
That's true. So it's kind of right. So the question is that has the nuclear weapons program achieved its goals? What has it given Iran and what it has it taken away? Right. My general view of what has happened to Iran, it has lost tremendously. This weapons program has cost it a lot. Over the last 20 years, it has been subject to sanctions which have crippled its economy. Those sanctions have crippled its ability to develop a conventional deterrent against Israel, to strengthen its conventional forces. And what does it has resulted in its total isolation in the world. And what does Iran have to show in the end? 406 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium, which doesn't really change much, you know. On all, if you look at this, this has been a major failure on the part of Iran. But this is not how people make decisions, right? I mean, the way the governments work is that they embark on something because they think, back in the days, they thought that they will be able to squeeze it through. And then they sort of may realize that it was a mistake, but it's too late. They are on that train, the train has left. And if they try to go back, if they try to essentially admit defeat and say, look, it was a mistake for us to go down this road, it will be, that itself will threaten the survival of the regime, right? So like similar thing, I guess, with Putin. Putin probably knows that going into Ukraine was a mistake, but now it's too late, right? He got on that thing. He has to go and hope that there is some kind of victory he can claim. And I think Iranian leadership is essentially hoping for that. You know, they feel that if they cancel their weapons program, they'll be in big trouble. And while realizing that if they continue with it, they will also be in big trouble. As you pointed out, there will be further repercussions if they continue with
this. Yeah, indeed. But let me ask you a question I think that most people have. Iran has consistently said that we are not developing a nuclear bomb. Yeah. We are simply enriching uranium. Now, is the level of enrichment so high as to lead powers to believe that they are indeed trying to develop the bomb? And I'm surprised that Iran has not yet been able to, do they have the technology, or are they still searching for what is at play here?
Yeah. So let me answer the last question. Do they have the technology? Can they get to the bomb just from technological point of view? Nuclear bomb is a 1940s technology. Our cell phones have way more advanced technology in it than a simple nuclear bomb. So technologically, it's not that hard to make a bomb. The reason it has been very hard is because of the political pressures, economic pressures, and now military pressures as well. Right? Those are the things that have stopped Iran really from getting there. Otherwise, they would get there. That's not too hard. In terms of, well, what is really Iran doing? Like, what's their intent is? Like, to me, there's no doubt that they're shooting for the bomb. Okay? There's a couple of kind of markers of that. 60% enriched uranium, you don't need that unless you're
trying civilian use, do you?
Yeah, there's absolutely no value of civilian use. But second of all, they have put up these cascades of centrifuges, okay? Those cascades of centrifuges are too little for civilian program, yet they are perfect for a weapons program, okay? The configuration of their nuclear program is ideal for weapons. It's useless for civilian system. And everyone understands this. They understand it. We understand it. The main reason why they say, oh, it's civilian, I think it's mostly posturing, in part because if they were to explicitly declare that they are going for a nuclear weapon, it would violate their commitment to the non-proliferation treaty on which they have signed. Okay, so it would be violation of international treaty that they have signed onto, and it would be violation of Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwa. So because of that, they have to continue posture and pretend like if that's that they are really going for a civilian program.
So when we hear the word nuclear, I always call myself a Cold War baby, right? When I hear the word nuclear, it's always red flags right, everywhere. Yeah. But with the recent attacks on the so-called nuclear program sites that Israel and the U.S. Initiated in Iran, how concerned should we be as a neighboring country to Iran? I mean, about the potential fallout. I mean, this involves political, security-related, environmental. And of course, we were concerned because if they're, bombing nuclear, is there going to be any kind of...
So let me talk about actual nuclear fallout, and then we'll talk about political fallout, metaphysical fallout. So in terms of the possible radiation contamination, the sites that have been sort of hit, the likelihood of real contamination is tiny. You know, it's like even on the sites, there is so far, there's no signs of contamination. There's really one site in all of Iran that if that site is hit, it will be a major problem for the whole region, all of region, not just Armenia, but Israel, everything. And that's a Bushehr civilian nuclear reactor, which is a civilian power reactor, Bavar 1000. That has not been targeted. And I think it will not be targeted for same simple reason that Israel will be one of the countries that will be immediately contaminated if that happens. But the other sites are not really a danger in terms of broad contamination, right? Now, the question is that, okay, so where are things going forward from here and what other things can happen? Right now, there's lots of back and forth as to the extent of the damage to the Natanz, to Fordo, to the Isfahan plant. You hear CIA said that the Isfahan plant, which is basically this is like metallurgical plant that can make fuel as well as a bomb, potentially the last stage of the thing, that has been severely damaged. The Fordo plant, Fordo facility, we don't know yet. There's not much news about Natanz either. But like knowing the depths and things like that, Natanz has probably been damaged severely. Fordo is still an open question.
Yeah,
right? It's still questionable. And again, there's back and forth. Trump said that it has been obliterated,
on the surface, perhaps, but maybe there are...
I mean, they try to use this super heavy GBU-57 mop bombs to penetrate through the mountain and to detonate the interior and damage it. And there are some external signs that at least they did hit it as to whether it has been successful. You know, Pentagon's Department of Defense has declared that they're still doing, you know, battle damage assessment, and that is, we don't know fully yet what will happen. But really, the question is that, okay, is it going to set back the program like 1 month, 1 year, 10 years exactly? That's the unknown.
Right? I mean, right, because if it's 1 year, then we should expect.
They would have to get bombed a year from now. Yes. It's going to be a giant mess, right? But here's the real thing, right? You can bomb facilities, but you cannot bomb knowledge. Mm-hmm. Okay. Knowledge is there. Iranians have developed it. Reverting it, other than going and killing every single scientist. Yeah, they killed the top 9 scientists or so, but those were mostly administrators. Okay, they are replaceable. You can't go and kill every single scientist over there. Iran has that knowledge. Okay, and as I said, it's 1940s technology. Okay, there is really sooner. You know, if they really want to, there is a chance that they might get to it. The reason there were so many people were against this military attack is because the worry is that now you are going to really drive Iran underground. Because things that, despite the fact that Iran has been clearly violating things, at least they have been sort of like being overt about it. Like the IAEA, every day they had inspectors accessing Fordo, Natanz, at every single facility. Now that's probably over. And Iran this morning declared that they are essentially kind of stopping their cooperation with IAEA.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So now they're going underground. Now, and this is precisely the scenario everyone was worried about. So if this military action had truly obliterated all their facilities and all that was left was the institutional and scientific knowledge, okay, maybe we could argue that this thing was useful. But if in the end, it turns out that they have managed to maintain some of their facilities and they have knowledge. And now there's a broad societal support for essentially cutting all contacts with IAEA, it looks like we may have a very messy situation going forward.
Who acts as police chief of the world is my question. I understand the treaties and all that. Yeah. So how is it that Pakistan...
Morally or objectively? Like morality or objective reality?
The objective reality.
Well, the reality is whoever is the strongest one.
Right? Okay. So Pakistan has a nuclear weapon.
Right. Uh-huh. Mm. Yeah. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. North Korea, Israel has nuclear weapons, many countries. The thing is that the history of the nuclear weapon development has been extremely variable. Since like 1945.
When was the last time a country developed the nuclear bomb?
That was North Korea. I think they had their first test. I may remember this wrong, in 2006, 2007.
So very, quite recently.
Relatively so recently, yeah.
For some reason, I thought it was the 80s and then it stopped after, non-proliferation treaties and such.
If you go back in time, in late 90s, Pakistan and India went fully nuclear. They had developed nuclear capacity. They were like threshold nuclear states as of 70s. And both had this policy that they're going to be one screwdriver turn away from having a bomb. Literally, they're going to have all the components. And then in late 90s, India decided to go full force, and then they tested their weapon. And then right after that, Pakistan tested their weapon, like within a month. And before then,
why were there no sanctions on Pakistan?
There was, United States did put lots of pressure on both countries not to do this. But ultimately, you know, they were, and Pakistan was subject to many, 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 I don't know if sanctions is a word, but definitely the United States put lots of limits on its cooperation with Pakistan after that. Pakistan was kind of like, was seen as a U.S. ally during the Cold War because of Afghanistan, right? And it had a very high standing with the Americans in the 80s, and that standing went down in the 90s. Because suddenly it wasn't that much more that useful to the United States after the end of the Civil War.
So it's about the level of your usefulness.
No, of course,
it?
Absolutely. That's objective reality.
Right. Well, a lot of happy things to look forward to, but let's switch over to Armenia and talk about Armenia's energy dependence, sure. The need for energy diversification.
Yeah.
And, you know, today Armenia relies heavily on Medzamor, its own nuclear facility. Yeah. But we know that it's to be decommissioned in about 10 years' time. What happens then? What are the possibilities for Armenia? I think about 30% of its energy needs
roughly
come from
one third.
And we're highly, highly dependent on Russia for our natural gas. We keep talking about green energy, solar energy, hydroelectric power plants, and all of this, but we're running out of time. especially with the geopolitical situation and Russia at any time, you know, using its economic levers as a way to pressure Armenia. What are the solutions that you see?
So let's draw like big fat red line between the Iranian topic and the Armenian topic.
Yes,
so people
please.
Don't conflate the two things.
We don't enrich uranium. We don't.
No, it's just because historically the problem with nuclear energy has been that people always conflate sort of nuclear energy with nuclear weapons, which, I mean, there is like technological, there is some common origins, but these days are quite different. Yeah, so let's maybe quickly cover the history of nuclear civilian power in Armenia. So, you know, Soviet Union built two reactors in the late 70s. In Metsamur, which is a Vever 440 type. These are pressurized water reactors. Their core technology is very similar to the one that is used in the United States, in Europe. 90% of the reactors in the world are pressurized water reactors, and Metsamur is of that type. This is why am I emphasizing this? Because people sort of tend to get confused. They think of Chernobyl, which is a RBMK graphite moderated reactor, which is a very kind of niche type of a technology.
What about Three Mile Island?
Three Mile Island was also a pressurized water reactor. And so far, despite the accident in early 80s in Three Mile Island, so far there is no registered increase in cancer rates in that vicinity. Right.
So 40 years later...
Yeah, so really, it doesn't mean there hasn't been an increase. There have not been, but we cannot attribute any cancers
to
the accident. Yeah. You know, these reactors were shut down in 1989. One of them was restarted in 95 after the severe energy crisis that we all went through in the early 90s. I mean, I was a kid at the time. We had to lug water to 11th floor, had no electricity. Like, we used to wear like, you know, coats at home.
And at school.
and at school, and schools were off. So in 95, Armenia reopened that one reactor. And so far, the safety record has been excellent. Like, I have had a chance to look at most of the documentation. I've talked to people from United States, from Department of Energy labs, specifically from Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, used to send people to review the safety protocols. And overall, they have been very... very impressed by the
safety. Have you been there yourself?
I have been there, yeah, a year ago. It's one of the places in Armenia where it seems like everyone is following every single rule.
Every protocol.
Every protocol, yeah. Like, I think the story that I told is that we walked into the control room and the reactor was off, so it was relatively low intensity period. And the director of the plant and myself, we accidentally crossed a red line. There was like drawn red lines on the floor, actual physical red line. And the workers turned around and started yelling at both of us. So when I see workers yelling at the director, it tells me that there's a fairly egalitarian system within the place. And that generally is a good sign. That's like a healthy organization, sign of organizational health. So, it has worked fairly well. And the Armenian government, I believe, has invested more than $500 million in safety upgrades over the last 20 years in this reactor, single reactor. It also has weaknesses. It has does not have the kind of containment building that most Western designs. It has a containment building, but it's not as strong as the ones that you typically see on Western designs. That has been a point of criticism. Lots of people talk about it being in a seismic zone. It's actually the zone where Metsamur is one of the least active places in Armenia. It is still an active zone because all of Armenia is active, but it's one of the least active places within Armenia. You know, so given that you're going to build a plant in Armenia, it's actually one of the better places to put a reactor at, and has been retrofitted with lots of seismic kind of constructions, you know, cross braces and whatnot to be stable and etc. So now this reactor cannot go forever. What happens is that it builds up fatigue. You know, different components as eventually will start fail. Where like talking to specialists, people are not really worried about catastrophic failures. You know, the kind of stuff we imagine in Hollywood movies. More like sort of component failures that make maintenance harder and more expensive. Eventually, it becomes too expensive to run. You know, kind of imagine a car that components fail, eventually just maintaining the car becomes just too expensive. It's better to just go get a new one. Now, what does it take to get a new kind of reactor? It's not like buying a car.
Right.
From the moment you make a decision to the moment it starts producing electricity, you have to assume 10 years. 5 years for planning, for preparation of the site, and then 5 years for the actual construction. Okay.
Not everybody builds nuclear reactors.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, most everyone builds, but some people build it more often, and other ones build it less often. Okay. The United States hasn't been too active in building reactors. We just had two reactors. Last 30 years, we had these two reactors that came online in Georgia, in Vodal, these AP1-2, AP1000 reactors.
But from what we know in the media is that the Armenian government has been in negotiations with the United States to build some modular, I don't know what the term is exactly,
small nuclear reactors.
Yeah,
so there have been quite a bit of discussions with the U.S. government, especially since last January that Armenia signed the Strategic Partnership Agreement that really paved the way for a lot of things that are necessary. Like Armenia needs to sign the 123 agreement with the United States, which will then open up, it will give it access to nuclear technologies on the higher level than the default that most countries have access to. Well, I talked to my colleagues at MIT and they say that once that's signed, they can really, it will be a lot easier for them to work with Armenians and to be without worrying about export control issues.
Right.
What does it mean to go the American way in this case? The United States, there's a couple of companies that are making nuclear small modular reactors. Now, the question is, what's a small modular reactor? And this word modular sort of confuses people a lot. People think of modular like as magic or something like that. So I'll tell you the following. There are very few truly small modular reactors. Most designs are really just small reactors. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole history about how we came where we are. In the 60s and 70s, people used to build small reactors. Metsamor is a small reactor.
Oh, it's considered to be small.
Yeah, it's 400 megawatt, 440
megawatt.
What
would an average or a large one produce?
A modern reactor is like 1,000 megawatt.
Okay.
Or 1,200, 1,400. Okay, so like AP1000 is 1,000 megawatt. Vovere 1200 is 1,200 megawatt.
So Armenia would just need a small reactor if we were to replace our energy, 30% of our energy needs.
Yeah, so for Armenia, what you need is you really need a small reactor. And the United States, there is like NuScale, which makes truly small modular reactors. General Electric, Hitachi are planning to build a BWRX-300 megawatt reactor in Darlington, Canada. So that could be a good kind of candidate. And Westinghouse, which historically has been building AP1000, is claiming that it's going to make a new design called AP300, which will be a 300 megawatt reactor. The trouble that you always have with nuclear reactors is first of a kind.
Meaning?
So first of a kind, it means like you make the first cell phone, you make the first bottle, and you always make mistakes when you do that.
Sure.
And you have cost overruns. The story with the AP1000s built in Georgia, United States, we're talking about the state, not the country, is that they ended up costing like almost three times more than they were expected because they were first of a kind. You build a new thing, which is extremely complex, which is what nuclear reactors, you're almost going to for sure make mistakes. When you make a mistake, you have to fix them. It's delaying things delayed because you have loans with very high interest that really increases the total cost, construction cost. So we're talking about the reactors, the small reactors, small modular reactors, whatever you want to call them, they haven't yet been built. So they will be small. They will be first of a kind. Well, in case of BWRX-300, maybe it won't be first of a kind. Maybe it will be second of a kind. But when Armenia is negotiating these things with the United States or whoever, in agreement, once that agreement contract is signed, they need to stipulate it clearly as to who carries the risks for budget overruns, for cost overruns, for timeline, kind of extensions and things like that. That really needs to be done clearly so that Armenia does not bear the burden of the risk, or at least the vendor manufacturer shares significant part of the of the burden. Yeah.
Are there countries or companies that are not American that do a better job of building nuclear reactors? That Armenia could potentially...
So if we're talking all type of reactors, the countries that have been very good at building stuff on time and on budget has been, unsurprisingly, Russia. China has been very good at doing things on time, on budget, and interestingly, South Korea. South Korea built four reactors in United Arab Emirates on time, on budget, big 1,400 megawatt reactors. French are building reactors. Areva built EPR in Finland, which did have a cost and schedule overruns, delays and things like that. But the thing about Russians is that they have this one design, Vovere 1200, and they just keep stamping those out.
Right.
It's
so
not first of a kind. It's like 20th of a kind at this point.
Right.
They've made all the mistakes. They really have learned from that. And they just... It's interesting that this last 30 years of post-Soviet rule, because they have not really had the capacity to develop anything new, it means they have been reproducing the same thing, which also has made... They have become very good at doing Chinese have been very good at, like, they have been building licensed AP1000s on time, on schedule. But also their, you know, their cost structure is very different than that in the United States. You know, their regulatory framework is vastly different, simpler than the one in the United States. A lot of the reasons for these cost overruns that I'm talking about and schedule delays.
There's a lot of layers that you would have to go through, right?
Yeah, you have to go through. There's like a regulatory framework in the United States is quite strict. In Europe, it's even more bureaucratic, more strict. So like right now, Trump administration is trying to change that, right? Okay. They're really trying to revamp NRC for better or for worse. You can argue for both to try to simplify this process.
Yeah. Right. Because in North America and Europe, things are very bureaucratic. Like you said, there's so many regulations. Yeah, yeah. Here in Armenia, we can get things done,
that's right. Yeah, it's interesting that the bureaucratic burden in Armenia is much lighter than in the United States.
We complain, but we complain about everything.
Yeah, yeah.
But Dadek, is nuclear energy the way for Armenia to go? I mean, in 10 years' time, could we not build up capacities in other forms of energy?
Yeah. So the question is, what are those other forms of energy, right? Like, really, the devil is in the details. There's lots of excitement about renewables. Armenia has quite a bit of solar. The problem, as you know, with solar is that sun doesn't shine when we need it to shine. It shines in the afternoon. We mostly need electricity in the morning and the evening when there is no sun. Oh, yeah, but wait, there's also wind.
You can't store energy?
So energy storage is a big problem. We don't really have good ways to store electricity.
Globally or in Armenia?
Globally.
Oh, okay.
That sort of problem is not solved. You can store it. Hey, you can have batteries. You know, we can pitch in our batteries. But that's like, we're talking about industrial scale. I mean, the amount
of energy. You were telling me a few days ago that you'd also need natural gas.
That's a different thing, right? There's energy storage where like we don't have simple solutions for that. Now, what it is that if you have solar, and because you don't have storage, you need to couple solar with natural gas. Why? You have solar panels, they are producing electricity, and suddenly clouds show up. Or let's say the demand goes up. Right. You end up having a deficit, electric deficit that will destabilize the grid. The grid will collapse if that happens.
The grid isn't working so good anyway. But that's
There's that whole different story. So you need another source on a standby ready to crank out lots of extra power instantaneously. Not instantaneously, within seconds maybe
say,
like tens of seconds, right?
Sure.
So natural gas is essentially that, where if you build lots of capacity, natural gas capacity, which Armenia has quite a bit of natural gas capacity, if I'm not mistaken, 1.6 gigawatts at Harazdan. Then you need to be able to couple it so that if the sun goes down or demand goes up, and then you can crank up those gas turbines in natural gas combined cycle plants to generate the necessary electricity. If you just look at this, like, oh, we still need natural gas. Yeah, but if you do that, you still will be burning less natural gas, but you still need natural gas. The modern nuclear power plants have also this ability to throttle themselves, to change. They're like old types, like Mezamor, they have to be run at full capacity. You cannot change their power at all.
But with the new ones, you could.
New ones, you can, yeah. And the way you do it, unfortunately, is like you throw away electricity, essentially. That's what you do.
Right.
If you try not to change the reactor is like is complex, in a sense, kind of like very demanding machine. You cannot change its temperature too much, too often, because then you're starting to build really stresses, and that builds fatigue. There's limited amount of times you can do that.
Yeah. Okay, so Armenia is going to need to stick to nuclear power, is what you're saying, basically.
So I think Armenia should use nuclear power because our nuclear power gives it significant amount of energy independence in terms of electricity production, which it would be hard today to do it with just solar. It would be very hard to do it with solar.
Let me ask you a question. If we were to get the new small reactors 10 years from now, would it produce more than 30% of our energy needs? Depending if it was a flat line, right?
Yeah. If the demand was
if the demand was the same.
It depends how many reactors you get. So Metsamor is 400 megawatts. Though some of the reactors I listed are 300 megawatts.
So we would need more than one.
Yeah, so you probably need two. So you know, our main government is talking about building two reactors, so that would be 600 megawatts. Which that you can see the problem with Armenia is that also the average electricity consumption in Armenia is 900 megawatts. That forces you to go small because when you have 900 megawatts, you cannot put 1,000. I mean, you could if you come up with some very complicated schemes, but putting 1,000 megawatt reactor
on your grid
on a grid that is in average consuming 900 megawatt would be hard. Now, if Armenia's electricity consumption goes up,
then what?
It's a different story altogether. For example, it goes from 900 to 1,000 because we keep opening, let's say we decide we'll be opening these computational centers, each one of them burning 100 megawatts.
Yeah, right.
Then perhaps you might need like more powerful reactors such as AP1000 or EPR or something like this. But the problem is that it's like very hard to predict what's going to happen.
Right. So you could invest in expanding your grid or making it stable enough to... then you don't need that energy.
It's a question of expanding your grid and also expecting a higher demand, people turning more lights or people consuming more electricity.
Well, if they would just stop cutting our electricity, we'd be very thankful because this past year and a half, right, 2 years, we've been, power outages have been constant almost. Yeah. I do want to explore one other area with you before I let you go on and do your important work. Mm-hmm. Do we have nuclear scientists in Armenia?
Depends what you mean by nuclear scientists.
I don't know. You explain it to me.
I'll explain what... My father is a nuclear physicist. My aunt was a nuclear physicist, experimental nuclear physicist. And Armenia has a history of doing experimental and theoretical nuclear physics, high energy physics, particle physics. But and this is where confusion starts happening.
Yes, because people think like me.
Yeah, people think that nuclear energy and nuclear physics is the same thing, right? It has the word nuclear. It must be the same thing, right? Well, deribonucleic acid also has the word nuclear in it. DNA is not a nuclear scientist. Okay. So if you look at nuclear reactors, nuclear engineering, I would say 10% of it is nuclear physics. Only 10%. Okay.
Okay. And do we have nuclear physicists then?
So we have nuclear physicists. Okay. No, but let's, okay. So we have nuclear physicists. Some of them, many of them have left, but many of them are continuing to come back and forth like me. But let's talk about specifically reactor specialists. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Armenia does have reactor operators. The Metsamor is primarily run by Armenians. Okay, when I was over there, everyone was Armenian. Most of them
They were Russian?
Huh? At some people, I don't remember. So in the 80s, there used to be lots of Soviet people. Right. Like there were Russian, Armenians, different people, Belarusians, Ukrainians, maybe Azeris, I don't know. But today it's mostly Armenians, which is Armenian citizens. Okay, most of them, they get their training in Yerevan State University and or Polytechnic Institute. And many of them used to go to Russia and get trained and cut back over there. Now, here's the thing. As much as I respect our reactor operators, and I do respect them sincerely because I have, I've talked to people, they have a good reputation, good safety record, all that stuff. They really are reactor operators. They are not nuclear engineers per se. Armenia needs nuclear engineers. Most of our reactor operators, they know the reactor like the back of their hand. They know everything about it, okay? But if you ask them any questions about other reactor designs, other concepts, what is available in the world, if you ask them questions about the economics of nuclear, which is one of the big questions we're trying to answer over here, they don't know it, okay? And they don't see that as their mission to know it. They really are focused on the reactor. So Armenia needs nuclear engineers. Okay, and it needs to create, in addition to building this reactor, it also needs to create educational programs, need to create essentially a pipeline for creation of nuclear engineer specialists.
And we don't have that now.
We don't have that now, no. But again, if you sign this 1-2-3 agreement, I think that will create an opportunity for Armenia to send its students to get trained in the United States, at MIT, at other places, and eventually they'll come back and create their own school.
I have to ask this question, Arek. I mean, just as a citizen of Armenia, as a journalist, mm-hmm. as somebody who thinks a little bit, how does it make sense that we have a nuclear reactor, mm-hmm. but we don't have nuclear engineers? We don't have programs in our university system to produce the kinds of experts that mm-hmm. we need to maintain. It's one thing to maintain it, like you said. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then what happens when these people die?
Well, so they keep retraining. They have new people coming
in. So I can go and be trained as a nuclear operator?
Now, if you are a physicist or if you are, let's say, electrical engineer from Polytechnique, mm-hmm. then in principle, you may get a job. And many of them, when I talk to them, many of them, they say that, I was a physicist, I got a job over here, and I went through a training process over the years, and now I know the reactor and this and that. I mean, look, if you are just running a reactor, that's not a bad idea. I mean, that thing has worked, right? The question is, why would you need nuclear engineers? Like the kind of ones I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So if you need nuclear engineers, if you want to do research in nuclear engineering, okay? If you don't have a program of research in nuclear engineering, you will train those nuclear engineers, like nuclear engineers, and they'll leave the country. They'll go to Europe. They'll work in Areva. They'll work in General Electric, United States. So now, on the other hand, if you are like, we're going to build these reactors and we need nuclear engineers to help drive policy, to help, kind of make decisions in the future, And possibly also, we want to have our own nuclear industry. Maybe not building nuclear reactors, but building components parts for nuclear reactors, sure. Right? And things like that. And then we could sell those parts to other countries mm-hmm. that need those parts and mm-hmm. things like that, right? So then you start saying that, okay, maybe a program, say a small program in nuclear engineering is actually justified. If you look at the history of nuclear engineering schools in the United States, you know, we had nuclear reactors starting from early 50s, but the real like MIT Department of Nuclear Engineering became a standalone department, if I'm not mistaken, in the late 60s. Hmm. And many of the programs in nuclear engineering used to be part of like mechanical engineering, chemical engineering, you know. It wasn't until much later that, you know, they separated, became standalone departments of nuclear engineering.
One final question, perhaps mm-hmm. an unfair question, but sure. since I get to ask the questions, absolutely. You know. R&D in Armenia, the intersection between academia, science, research, security, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. is there a future? Do you see a future in that?
As my Italian ex-wife used to say, Italian expression, you know, the hope is the last thing to die.
Oh, we also say that in Armenia, yeah, so it's not only the Italians.
She mostly used to say it ironically. But
because you were Armenian, probably.
Yeah. So the question is, of course, there is future, right? The question, but in order to discuss...
There's a future if there's a plan and if there's a foundation. So...
So I think the question we need to ask, well, why hasn't it been as good as it should have and could have been? And the biggest problem that I see in Armenia when it comes to the kind of collaborative, multidisciplinary work that you describe is that education in Armenia, for reasons that are historic, not even limited to the Soviet Union, they actually come from Germany. This is what we have right now are the vestiges of the 19th century German system, okay, where you have very sharp distinctions between science and engineering. And even you have this very, very narrow stovepiping and siloing of different disciplines within sciences itself. Like, I'll give you an example. When I was an undergraduate student at MIT, I barely spent 30% of my time in department physics, being a physicist. Most of the time I spent, when I had to learn mathematics, I would take classes with mathematicians at the department of mathematics. When I took classes in biology, I would take classes of biology with biologists. When I took classes of music, which mm-hmm. I also did, mm-hmm. I would take it with musicians in the department of music.
But so that's not how it is here?
Here, if you look at the curriculum of a physics student is born, grows, and dies in the department of physics. 95% of their life is within the department. Even mathematics is taught within the department of physics.
And not in the department of mathematics.
And not in the department of mathematics. Not all of it. I am not sure why. It's probably
that's
like
how
turf
the
things.
System is.
But that's how system has been built. Chemistry, biology, humanities, forget that. They don't know that. And if you call an Armenian physicist an engineer, that's a major insult. And engineers don't want to learn any science. It's so ghettoized. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, mm-hmm. And that those concrete walls that make up those silos, they need to be torn down. Okay, because the problems of the future are highly multidisciplinary. In the current system, it's absolutely. Very hard to do anything multidisciplinary. Okay, so this is like this education reform that I'm saying. You know, something like this is urgently necessary.
And you've conveyed this. You've been talking about this.
Yes. You can sort of like I can say these things. People will even agree with me. But the question is, well, for it to change, there need to be specific incentives. People don't change their work style because they realize that it's a wrong work style. People change their work style when there's a specific system of rewards, okay, and deterrence for particular behavior. If you reward the right behavior and deter and punish the wrong behavior, then you'll have a good organization. It's not really about people. It's about organizational culture. And right now we have an organizational culture that goes back to the 19th century German
system. And we don't think in terms of systems and we don't think in terms of, you know, tearing down walls. We like to be in those silos oftentimes, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, fascinating conversation. I think we could probably go on for a long time talking about other topics. But thank you so much for taking the time to help elucidate the situation, nuclear energy, diversification of energy, academia, research, all of that.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.